It's 1 o'clock, and you're in tune to KZSU Stanford. And the views or opinions expressed by the host, DJ, or the guests present on KZSU 90.1 FM Stanford do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Leland Stanford Junior University or its associates. We thank you for tuning into this KZSU broadcast, and stand by for another edition of Shedding Lights. Welcome to another edition of Shedding Light here on KZSU. It's Monday, the 30th of November, almost the end of the year. And I am really honored and proud to have in the studio two folks, local prominent folks too. The editor-in-chief of East Palo Alto Today and founder of East Palo Alto Community Media, Miss Henrietta Burroughs.
Thank you so much, Bird. It's such a delight to be here.
And also, you brought a kind of a guest of your own today.
Yes, I have.
And I got a feeling you guys got this traveling roadshow going on, because this is not the first time you'll have done this.
So for I'm not, radio, yes,
okay, it is. This is not an exclusive scoop. But anyway, we have the Chief of Police of East Palo Alto, Mr. Ron Davis. Ron, welcome to KZSU.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. I know you got to be busy, so to take time out on any day is we're honored by that.
I look forward to it.
And Henrietta, as the editor-in-chief of East Palo Alto today, you're getting ready to put out your next issue. It's real
yes,
close, right?
Yes, we are, the December issue.
And this has been going on for quite a while, right?
It has been going on since January 2006.
Well, isn't that one? And how is it going?
Well, it's going quite well. I mean, it's really exciting to be able to deliver news to the community. Unlike any other media has been delivering news to the community, we're giving profiles and features about issues that community members can't read anyplace else.
Mm-hmm. And East Palo Alto had been without a paper like
yours. For 20
yours.
Years.
Wow.
Yes, so this is the first continuously published newspaper in 20 years.
And how often does it come out?
Well, when we started it, we wanted it to come out twice a month, and we said it's a bi-monthly. And bi-monthly has two meanings, twice a month or once every 2 months.
So what is it, Henrietta?
Well, it's coming out once every 2 months.
Okay.
We're going to move it up next year to once a month, and we will get there to twice a month.
Very
so
good.
So there are always goals that one can be striving for.
Sure. And my idea, you've been on the airwaves here. I think it was about 2.5 or 3 years ago when I first started this show, you did the lunch special with me.
Yes, I did. And I brought in my favorite records, and we played records,
we
and
had
then
a ball.
We talked, and it was just, I enjoyed it so much.
Well, thank you. We enjoyed having you. But I really look forward to this, because I'd like this to be the start of a collaboration between KZSU and you and the paper in East Palo Alto, because I think East Palo Alto needs a bigger voice, and you have instant media right here, so you know, to me it's a no-brainer. Let's get together and
well,
air it out.
I would love to, and we can look at this as our second effort in that direction.
Beautiful. And you suggested that we bring in Chief Davis today. Chief Ron Davis, can you kind of introduce yourself to the folks? Are you new to the force in East Palo Alto?
No, I've been in East Palo Alto now about 4.5 years. Before that, I spent 20 years in Oakland.
Okay. Are you a native of Bay Area?
No, originally from Philadelphia, and came out here via the service some 25 plus years ago.
Okay. Now, you were in Philadelphia for a while, weren't you?
No, I wasn't. I was in New York City.
Okay. All right.
Relatives in Philadelphia. But
well, as a side note, I sell pretzels for a living, so someday you're going to come by my booth and tell me what you think.
All right.
Because I love messing with anybody from Pennsylvania about the pretzels. But that's another thing. But Henrietta mentioned Chief Davis that you two did a show on her cable access show, and I guess it had a specific point to it, didn't it?
Well, we have sat and talked with Henrietta on several different occasions about a variety of different topics. And a few weeks ago, Chief Davis and I sat with Assembly Member Ira Ruskin, and we were talking about crime initiatives. Now, I brought Chief Davis with me today because we had a recent discussion about the hood and the culture of the hood, and up came the topic of the culture of the Brotherhood, because we've been focusing the community and the police department in East Palo Alto about some of the cultural values of community members where they don't snitch, which means they're crimes, but people don't feel free to say anything to the police about it. And the idea is, okay, how do you reach the community? And at the same time, what are the dividing points between the community and the police? And it just so happens that the police have a code of silence, which is no snitching. And now, if you're going to bring changes to the cultural values of one community, it seems that you may have to consider bringing changes to the cultural values of another community.
Now, you mentioned the hood, and Henrietta, you're a very eloquent speaker, and to hear you say a word like that, it sends chills up my spine. I love it, because that's an understanding that we all got to have. There's a neighborhood down there, and it's called the hood. Then you mentioned the brotherhood, and what is the brotherhood?
Well, I will let Chief Davis talk to us about the brotherhood.
I know we've been kind of keeping them, keeping them all boxed.
Feel free, go ahead.
I got a feeling Chief Davis is, I don't know, what's Chief Davis, speak to this. You guys have had this conversation, so this is not, yes. This isn't an ambush thing or anything.
Well, if I may first start by saying that I think Henrietta's paper, the EPA Today, and also Talking with Henrietta, has been an invaluable tool for the police department and for me specifically to communicate to the police, to the community.
Hmm.
Quite often, I mean, we can have community meetings, but it may be limited in participation. So to have a venue where people can listen to you, see you, read about the things that are going on has been very beneficial. I agree with Henrietta with regards to the code of silence, but I'll expand it a little bit. I think the challenge with the code of silence is real in our community with regards to reporting crime. But I think the challenge of the code of silence is societal, whether it's the president of the United States or past presidents, whether it's high-profile actors, whether it's elected officials, or whether it's police officers. The notion that somehow reporting misconduct is a negative seems to permeate through our society, to the point where we have to come up with laws to protect whistleblowers. And so we see this in corporate America, we see it in private America, and I don't think the police department is exempt. And I agree, if we are going to encourage people to participate and take the chances to report crime and to report violence when they see it, then the police department has to be the lead organization to do that. So one of the challenges I think most chiefs face is really destroying or tearing down that idea of the code of silence and really understanding why it exists.
I don't think that there are, how many examples can we give throughout society about codes of silences? I mean, we have it with the mafia. We mentioned we have it with the hood. We mentioned we have it with the police department. Mm-hmm. Do we have it in any other official structures? We have groups of people who are trying to keep silent about their activities, but is there some unwritten law or some unwritten code?
Well, I think most organizations or disciplines have their own culture. So whether Scooter Libby not telling, whether it's one of the most famous rappers who went to jail because she decided not to snitch and receive praise.
Lil' Kim,
thank you. Whether it's police officers from across the country that would not report misconduct right in front of them. I think the larger issue is the issue of why this occurs. And I think if you look at a code of silence, there's two ways to look at it. One, I think the most appropriate way to look at it is that it's not a conspiracy of any group, in my opinion, to do malicious deeds. But once a culture comes together and creates its own inner circle or its own insular society, then you end up embracing a we versus them mentality, which means you have to protect we versus them.
But you're there to protect them. Not we. So right. It seems that this is something that undermines the actual police force itself.
Oh, absolutely. The we versus them mentality, whether it's the code of silence, is very counterproductive. But I think it's one thing to call it counterproductive. It's another thing to understand why it exists. And I don't want to demonize a natural behavior that any organization is likely to have. When people feel like they're not understood, when officers feel like the community is not connected to them, that they place their lives at risk only to be scrutinized to the point of being blamed for every societal will, then it causes them to become very insular. And this is around a country, which means the only person that's going to take care of me is another one that looks like me. So the challenge of community policing is to break that, for them to see themselves not separate from the community, but a significant part of the community. And if they do that, then it's not a code of silence, because who are you keeping it away from? You are the community. The community is you. And so the idea of the we versus them is counterproductive. And so we attack it at that root cause versus the code of silence, which is really a manifestation of the idea that we are an insular group and therefore we protect ourselves. And also you have with the military, we've seen this on a couple atrocities recently where the code of silence came through. When men and women are placed in great risk, continued risk, they do forge a brotherhood that, if not checked and if not managed properly, would lead to people thinking that in the interest of justice, that we protect each other and actually see themselves doing good. And I'm not agreeing with that. I'm saying these are the challenges. And so as the chief or any manager in a police organization, it is to attack it at that level.
Well, it seems to me that given the shootings of the four officers in Lakewood, Washington. That
terrible thing. And we want to just send our condolences out to all the families and the victims and everybody. That was horrible. Yeah. God.
It's interesting how we could talk about maybe two communities who see themselves under siege. And I would think right now the police department in Lakewood, perhaps the police department in Oakland, would see itself under siege from various members of the community. I would think members of the community, let's say in East Palo Alto, might see themselves under siege with respect to the police. And how do you break down those perspectives?
Well, I think, and I'll turn back to our own tragedy in January 2006 when Richard May was shot and killed. It was interesting because the initial reaction inside the organization from many who had been there for a while was the idea that they were under siege until they saw the outpouring. And I literally mean the overwhelming outpouring of support from the community that shared with them the loss, that it wasn't just one of their brothers or sisters that was fallen. That was the community looked at it as one of our community members fell. And so I think that understanding was a catalyst for many of the programs we've tried since then in working together. So, I mean, I think we cannot ignore the history of law enforcement with regards to especially communities of color. And we know that there's a lot of mistrust, and it could be from incidences or cases that occurred before most more officers were even born or even hired. And so we have the philosophy that we try to improve relationships one contact at a time, one day at a time, and it's a perpetual goal. That is a constant working at it, and that there's going to be major setbacks, some of our own doing, and some that may come from other agencies. The BART shooting is a good example. Well, it wasn't East Palo Alto officers, but it definitely had an impact on the relationship between the community and East Palo Alto Police Department. So we want to keep trying to improve relationships, make ourselves accountable, make public our steps that we take to stop the anything like a code of silence and make the officers a part of the community. And we think that's the way to do it. But we've made a few steps, but I got a long way to go.
Chief, you're listening to Shedding Light here on KZSU, and we're listening to a conversation between East Palo Alto Chief of Police Ron Davis and Editor-in-Chief of the East Palo Alto newspaper, East Palo Alto Today, Ms. Henrietta Burrows. And Chief Davis, you mentioned about the police force becoming part of the community. Would it help if they lived there?
You see me smile.
The
audience can't see me smiling.
Yeah.
Because it comes up a lot. I personally am not a proponent of the idea, and I'll tell you why. And I'll throw it back as a question. I want our profession not to be a vocation, but to be a profession. And as such, that you should be very committed to any community you serve, committed to the code of ethics in that profession. And so when you go to the doctor, you want the best brain surgeon there is, and the last thing you ask for is your driver's license to see where you live. Because you know that person's commitment to their profession and to you as their client is based on their professionalism and their morals, not where they reside. I do understand why the community wants people from the community, because they still feel disconnected and are under the belief that somehow it would make them serve the community better. And it may, but I think when I recruit for officers, I want to find them everywhere and anywhere I can to only get the best to come to East Palo Alto. And sometimes asking to disrupt their families, to relocate, may narrow your field. So there's probably some benefits. I think the bigger benefit is getting them to be committed to a profession, a code of ethics, and the community they serve. And living there doesn't mean you do that.
Do any of your officers live in East Palo Alto?
I think probably one, not very many. Some live in on the peninsula, and some live pretty good distance away.
Hmm.
Well, you talked about professionalism, and I know on my most recent show that talks about the 2009 Youth Summit, one guest talked about a good officer and a bad officer. Hmm. So when it comes to professionalism, tell us, what are the standards of professionalism as far as the East Palo Alto Police Department's concerned?
Well, I will share with you, thank you for the question. The first standard is in our actually recruiting and hiring efforts. And I think one is identifying what those standards are so that when you recruit people to those standards. And I've been very pleased at our outcome over the last few years. The second one is that the person becomes an expert in their profession. So technical competence is very, very important. Education is important. We're hiring more and more officers. We recently hired a civilian employee as a graduate from Stanford, more and more officers that have degrees. And really getting into why they decided to become police officers as far as service. But once they get in the department, once they're trained, is holding them accountable to provide a service. And really defining what that service is and then giving value to that service so that an arrest becomes a tool, not the goal, that a positive interaction becomes success, not a hindrance, and that the stronger the relationship, the greater their success. So internal to the organization, I have to set mechanisms so that they're valued like that. And external, we have to hold the officers accountable to that. So professionalism to me means that they understand the diversity of East Palo Alto, that they understand the power, quite frankly, that they carry. It's a very awesome power and responsibility, the ability to restrict freedom and to take life when necessary, and that they do it judiciously and professionally, and that they understand that they are held accountable by the community because that's who they work for, that they're not a separate entity from the city. They are part of the city family.
Does the racial makeup of a police force play into any of that, how they relate to the community?
I think so. I think the race or gender of an individual officer does not make him or her any better, but the diversity of the organization does make it greater. And I think one of the things we're very proud of is Palo Alto. We have an extremely diverse organization, which means we have varying perspectives. We have differing views, and when time to affect policy, the more diversity, the more views, the better decision you make. And most recently, we had a raid involving a family, a Pacific Islander family in East Palo Alto. And in one sense, the legal aspect of it was all met, but on the other sense, it caused a lot of strain in our community. I recently hired 4 Pacific Islander officers, and in talking with the officers about this incident, one of the things they immediately shared with their colleagues is that the family was upset not because of the legality. They appreciate and embrace law and order as a culture. But there were things that occurred they thought were disrespectful to the culture. And then he shared what those things were. And we were thinking is, you know, this is a way for the officers to see that they can still enforce law and order, but do so in a manner that's actually embraced by the community and not turn off the community. And this is why we started, as Henrietta knows, our cultural competency series training so that they can learn more about the varying cultures in East Palo Alto.
And what difference do you think that's going to make?
From looking at the reactions of the officers and the discussions, I think it's going to make a huge direction, a huge impact, because a good example would be if knowing the impacts of your decision. So you may have to serve the search warrant and nothing, no one's suggesting that you don't serve it. But knowing the impact on a family, knowing who to talk to in a family, knowing what is considered disrespectful and respectful may make the execution of that search warrant more respectful to that family and the larger family that's also paying attention to it. And you can do so. And this is the key for the officers, is you're not asking them to do something unsafe. You're not asking them to do something that compromises safety. You're asking them to enforce the law, but to do so in a respectful manner, acknowledging and embracing that respect may be interpreted different. And if you can accommodate, and this is the key, and a family shared this with me, and if I consider this cultural impact, but I cannot accommodate because of safety, then at least I know the impact before it occurs, which means I can start the outreach and at least explain to you why I had to make the decision that I made, that I would prefer to have done another decision, but in the interest of the community, this is how it had to be done. Even that is a form of respect. So I think this cultural competency gives officers a way to be respectful without losing the ability to enforce the law, and that's usually what cops are concerned about.
You know, it's funny because a lot of the troops that come back from Iraq, especially in 2004, 2005, early on, were saying that they were participating on these raids on houses, and they knew when they were walking in that they were completely disrespecting these people, and they felt for them terribly, but they had to do their job because right. They were all protecting each other. And that's the biggest complaint we've heard from the soldiers, that it was a cultural thing that they didn't understand and they weren't trained for that.
Right.
And that was probably a big piece of the breakdown there that led to such a tragedy we're in now.
Exactly.
I would almost think when you talk about cultural competency, we're talking about maybe a total turnaround. an attitude? Because usually when one thinks of the police, people think of people who wear the gun and people who have a superior attitude, that they are better than the people who are out there in the street. And they have the power of life and death, and they represent the law. And they themselves can then be above the law. So what would they care about your culture? We represent the law, and this is the law.
You know, and I hear that a lot. So I agree with you that many people feel that way. And I'll share with them when Richard died, and the question was, what's the big deal? Not to minimize life. Why is Richard, the officer's life, more important than a civilian's life? And what I shared for them, and I think recently we heard, that there is a distinct difference between dying in the community and dying for the community. And that when the officer is doing his or her duties, it's not the individual that has the power. The uniform represents the community. You vote for the elected officials to pass the law. You vote for the governor, the legislative, and you have the right under the Constitution of the pursuit of happiness and to establish laws. And if you think about it, you then use your police officer as a vehicle to enforce your will. So the superiority or the power is that of the community. And the better we get officers to understand it, the better the community understands that the police officers are a tool in which they enforce their cultural laws and the laws that they have passed. Police officers don't pass laws. We can't vote for laws. All we can do is vote for the elected officials who actually enact laws. But I think when you look at the police officer as being the law, then you almost have to put them at this superior level. And if you do that, they can never live up to the standards that you want them to live up to. If you look at them as, not to minimize them, but simply a tool, and that they represent the community and the power of the community, then every time someone runs from the police, they're not running from Officer Davis, they're running from the East Palo Alto, all 40,000 people in East Palo Alto, and their ability to say that what we will or will not tolerate. That's what they're running from.
I am sure the community would love to think that it's that way. Mm-hmm. But I would think the police would think that they are not, while they might be beholding to the community, they're more than just beholding to the community. They're more beholding to the criteria of what the police are all about, because it's not the community who determines what the police will do.
In a way, most of the activities of the police department is governed by law, and it's the community that passes the law or that elects the representatives to pass that law. There is, and I think we as a community sometimes need to be cautious what we ask for. In one sense, you want the police department, and Sir Robert Peel, as the founder of law enforcement in 1829, had a principle that the police are the public are the police. And if you look at through society and our history, when there was segregation and that was the law of the land, it was the police that enforced it, Jim Crow laws. So we reflect quite often this code of silence. It reflects the community. What we try to do by professionalizing the police department is to serve the community, be part of the community, but not be inappropriately influenced by politics or the community. So the community may want something that is just counter to what is good policing and counter to the law. And so in one sense, you want them to be accountable to the letter of the law as passed by the legislature and not by any individual group. On the other sense, how you enforce that law or apply it is where you may tailor it to respect the varying cultures. But you do want a police department. It's like the fire department. Regardless of what kind of fire it is, there are standards on how to put it out. And you want to hold a fire department to that standard and not to be influenced inappropriately by politics. A police department influenced by politics is considered corrupt. So there has to be a part that is accountable to the community, responsive to the community, but is dictated as far as the enforcement of law by law and by the legislature, which includes the city council. You just can't have there's a balancing act, and I think we have to be very careful with that.
Now, Henrietta mentioned just a minute ago that when officers get an attitude about they're above the law, mm-hmm. and they get that, they go a little bit beyond where they should. I'm wondering, is there a way as the Chief Davis, that you can pick that out, spot that? Because I know that your role here is to run the ship, right? You're
right.
Driving this thing. And so ultimately it kind of comes back to you of if this department is acting one way or another, it's going to reflect on you. So you want to make sure it does the right thing.
That's right. I mean, with all of the conversation we had, I think Henrietta struck a few major points, and it would also do act above and beyond the call of duty, or actually the constraints of duty, and believe they start having superior attitude, then it does show up. And so we have systems in place that we would monitor the amount of complaints they get. We monitor the amount of force they may use, how many incidents, level of force. We pay attention to their work record, their work product. We have, since we have a small community, we pay both attention to informal information and formal information. And you look at individual officers, you hold them accountable for their behavior. So, for example, the first thing I set when I got hired as chief were the five deadly sins. And what that suggested to the officers at that time is one of these five were automatic removal from police service. And that was untruthfulness, because the officer's credibility must stand high for a jury to believe him or her. The other one was brutality. The idea of, you know, you cannot exceed the authority to use force is an awesome responsibility that should only be used when it has to be. The issue of retaliation against a witness, and that's both inside the organization and out, so that officers can report misconduct and not worry about some type of retaliation in a locker room. Accepting gratuities. In other words, the paycheck is the only reward other than your personal reward that you get. And I'm getting slow here.
Yeah, the fifth deadly sin.
I guess how deadly is going to be right now. Discrimination, I'm sorry.
Okay.
And the first one, and the fifth one is discrimination, which would include profiling or discriminatory acts both inside and outside the organization. Now, there's many other violations that could lead to disciplinary action and termination. But by setting those are the ones to me that clearly would make a community, if the community heard officers were engaged in this behavior, would question the very integrity of the department. So I'm not going to be here. I mean, we talked a lot about what officers should and should not do. And whenever you have a group of people, you're going to have imperfection. You're going to have good officers, you're going to have bad officers. And I hope that the way the community will gauge me as a chief is, one, that we use a hiring standard that hire the best, that we set standards for them to follow. And probably most importantly, if they don't, that they're held accountable and they're no longer allowed to be part of this community. That's really the strength of an organization.
If the code of silence is in place in a police department, can they counteract that by, you know, kind of putting a barrier between, you know, making themselves look good if they all kind of hang together and steal? Oh, no, I wasn't over there. I guess my question is, are there ways that they can circumvent that? Because it sounds like you got some very good tools in place. And I haven't heard a lot of stuff about the East Palo Alto Police Department. I don't live there. And
I haven't heard a lot about it either. Now, I don't know if that's because it's being covered, huh?
No news is good news, no, right?
Sometimes.
Don't end up in Henrietta's paper.
No, I think part of the haven't heard something for a while is that there's been progress. And I think the way we get to the code of silence was the first deadly sin that I mentioned was untruthfulness. And that one means, and there's a phrase we have, if you lie, you die. And it's starting to be embraced nationwide in the law enforcement community.
And what does that mean?
That means if I do an internal investigation and I ask you, did you see Ron Davis use excessive force or any type of force, lying for that will result in your termination.
But you know what? And I hate to stop you, but there is the idea when there is an internal investigation that it's not going to be a complete internal investigation. You do not leave it up to police to investigate themselves.
That was going to be my next question. What's your internal affairs? Do you have an internal affairs division in East Palo Alto?
Right. We have a professional standards division that we started. And for us, those cases that would fall into that deadly sin is I outsource them. In other words, I bring in an outside investigator.
Is that another police officer from another jurisdiction or a civilian?
It can be a civilian. It can be ranged from a retired chief to an attorney who deals with police labor issues. And there's several firms that are out there. And they do the investigation, gather the information, and then the final decision is ultimately mine as a chief, whether I believe that that's occurring or not. And one of the things the community do to watch that, because I think it's a very good comment, and that's shared with me a lot, even when I first got there, and even today, is can you really investigate yourself?
Right.
And I think the community should ask that question and should always ask that question. And so one of the ways I try to address that is I put out a report every year about a complaint summary report that tells the community how many complaints came in, what they're for, the adjudication of those cases, so they get an idea what percentage we believe the officers are engaged in misconduct versus what we don't. And they get an idea of what kind of complaints are made against officers. I even have put out that if an individual, once they get a letter as a, this is what happened to your case, that if they're not satisfied with the case, that they can schedule an appointment to talk to me personally. They get an idea of what they, make sure that whatever they offered was showed up in the investigation. And there's always ways to appeal a certain process or go to share that if it's not happy through an attorney. So there are some checks and balance, but you're right. The internal investigation by its nature requires some trust that the department has the ability to investigate itself. And I think the only way to do that is to take serious the idea of investigations. So, for example, in East Palo Alto, you can file an investigation or a complaint online. You can do it anonymously. We have kiosks set up around the city that you can file. And my policy requires supervisors shall accept all complaints. They will all be investigated, and they all have certain timelines, and they all come on my desk to see whether I agree. Now, quite frankly, I've overturned many investigations where the investigator said it was not true, and I basically say I think it is, or kick it back saying I need more, that it was too much of a focus on trying to clear versus trying to identify the truth. And that's the check and balance we have, because I know the individual cases is not where the community trust is going to come in. It's the trend. And so the best thing I can do for the officers is to hold them accountable, to change their behavior so that the community has respect and trust for them, not somehow cover it up, knowing that you didn't have a powder keg that just simmering, waiting for an incident to make it blow.
Have you had to fire any officers?
I would say in my short time, I've recommended termination on a couple, demotion on a few. I've released no less than 7 from probation for not meeting the standards that I believe that the department and the community deserve. So, yeah.
You have?
Yes.
Wow.
You know, it's one thing to have the standard out there. And I think there is a very crucial balance that has to be maintained. And people would say, okay, now you have these high standards, but how does that affect morale within the ranks?
That is the balancing act of the chief. And that's where you have to be careful of the code of silence that you're talking about, because if the officers become the scapegoat for everything that goes wrong, then they're going to automatically come together.
Right.
And so one of the things for me is I believe in a top-down accountability mechanism. And that you start with the commanders and the sergeants are held accountable for ensuring that staff is trained and have the resources to do the job, the equipment to do the job, and that you correct them along the way. You address small items before they become big items, and you then hold people accountable. And when they do overstep the boundaries, that you are reasonable in how you hold them accountable so that the officers can look in the mirror or go in a locker room, shut the door, and realize, yes, he was wrong, and what he got was fair or what she got was fair. Where they start messing with morale is when they think management will use them as political scapegoats and sacrifice them to save the job of the chief. So they have to know that there is a consistent standard, and that standard will be held when nobody is paying attention to it, and is held when the world is watching, that you cannot falter because it's on CNN, that the standard is the standard, and you need to hold people accountable to that standard regardless of the attention paid.
You can tell me if this is a fair question. You have something of a namesake in San Jose, the chief of police, who's also
my
Davidson.
Brother Robert.
And he has come under a lot of fire, and there are a lot of different groups that are calling him to task, saying that the San Jose police are using too much force, they're undisciplined. Some of the things that we've been talking about now that you're attempting to make some inroads in terms of, what type of advice, how would you assess, first of all, what's going on in terms of San Jose? And what type of advice would you give him?
I've known Chief Davis, Robert Davis, for a while. And so I'm biased, and I think he is a good leader and a ethical, strong character individual. And if we were talking about it, and I don't know a whole lot to make a judgment whether it's to what extent it exists, but this old phrase that most of us have is that perception is reality. So whether you think it's real or not, the community perceives it, so you have a problem. And I think the any advice that I would give would be openness, is get it out early, get it out fast, get it out open, and then identify how you plan on responding to it. And I think you can't, the facts are what they are. people's perceptions are what they are. And I think people more than anything just want to know that you are listening to them, that you're concerned about what they're concerned about, and that you will have a sincere effort in trying to hold people accountable or improving the organization. That would be any recommendation I would give to any chief. That's not just San Jose, and including myself in dealing with issues. Whenever you have an organization, you got to figure out how big San Jose is. When you got 2,000 officers, unfortunately, people are people, and they're going to do good things, and every once in a while, they're going to make a mistake. There's a theory that I have with mistakes, and it's one that I heard from one of my mentors, Oakland Chief, from years ago, that said that there's two kinds of mistakes, Ron. There's the mistake of the mind that we make every day, and then there's the mistake of the heart. The mistake of the mind is when people don't follow procedures, if they get to do things, don't complete a thorough report. You hold them accountable, you change their behavior, you provide more training. Mistake of the mind, the mistake of the heart is a character flaw, which means they should not be inside the service. And those are the ones that you target to remove from policing. And so what you have to look at your organization and look at the mistakes and see what they are. I mean, you can't accept mistakes of the mind every day, but you know they're going to occur.
You were a captain in the Oakland Police Department.
Yes.
Were you there when the Oakland Riders, were they called the Oakland Riders?
Yes. Yes, I was.
You were there.
Mm-hmm.
You knew those guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you know what they were doing?
Personally, no. I mean, they didn't work for me, but I knew what the organization was at the time. And I think and part of why I think the way I do and implement the policies that I have is learning from that period of time. One of the jobs I had before I left Oakland was Inspector General of the Department. And so as such, my job was to audit and inspect internal affairs, the department management, to see if they're following the rules and the policies of the department and also the agreement that came out of the riders. So there's a lot of lesson in any organization. When I got to East Palo Alto, the grand jury report going back to 2000 is another way to look at the lessons that an organization can learn. As you also know, Henrietta, I spent since 2002 under contract with the U.S. Department of Justice investigating police departments that are accused of being engaged in a pattern or practice of unconstitutional behavior. So I've seen the inside of the departments from policy to uses of force, and I try to use all those experiences to then bring it to East Palo Alto to make it a better department.
I did not know that about you. You worked for the Department of Justice investigating other police forces, huh?
Yes.
And was that while you were in Oakland, or was that a separate job you took separate from?
While I was in Oakland, there was a period of time where I took a sabbatical, and I was not only did I investigate police departments, the ones that came under consent decree, I served on two federal monitoring teams. So I was one of the federal monitors in Washington, D.C., in Detroit. So it gave me a perspective of seeing an organization, investigating the organization to see what condition that led to the consent decree, then monitoring an organization under a consent decree, and then being an inspector general of the department that's under a similar consent decree and doing the audits and inspections. And that's what I bring to East Palo Alto, and understanding organizational behavior, reform, and what leads organizations to even get into that kind of trouble that the U.S. DOJ would want to investigate you.
What did you see in that time that surprised you, or maybe you didn't know about before, or did you see anything like that?
Yeah, there are some common themes from East Coast to West, and I think Henrietta and yourself, you hit on some of the key. One, when you have an insular department, in other words, the organization is not a learning organization. And what I preach to chiefs around the country and to my staff is you're in a profession. And if there's a good practice somewhere in the country, you should know about it. Imagine if your attorney didn't know about a case law in another state that could free you, or your doctor didn't know about how to cure cancer because he didn't read a journal. So as a professional, make sure you understand your profession and not become insular. Let your people out so that they learn about the profession. Two, the more disengaged they are from the community, the more abusive that relationship ultimately turns out to be. And three, the inability to have structural systems in an organization to hold people accountable leads to the mistrust, and it's just a cycle that keeps going. And you see these in organizations that come under investigation that ultimately end up coming under a consent decree. And it's scary sometimes on how consistent and they are. And so when I look at East Palo Alto, this is why we're going for our national accreditation process. This is why policies mean something. The internal investigation means something. Investigating uses of force, the hiring standards, holding management accountable. Because I know the failure to do those things is what leads to the level of misconduct or unconstitutional behavior that usually results in oversight, mandatory oversight versus civilian oversight.
You're listening to another edition of Shedding Light on KZSU with East Palo Alto Chief of Police Ron Davis and Editor-in-Chief of East Palo Alto Today, Henrietta Burrows. Mm-hmm. And Chief Davis, I'd like to ask this question. I was Henrietta and I were talking over the weekend, and this is something that a lot of folks have been wondering about. When Oscar Grant got shot on the BART platform back in at the beginning of the year, mm-hmm. The officers collected cell phones off the all the folks on the platform, and the video that came out was from kids that were on the leaving train. We only saw the video from the kids who were on the train. All the other phone cameras got collected. And my question is, if those kids hadn't taken that video while they were leaving on that train, would we have ever seen, this is a kind of a hypothetical question, mm-hmm. but a lot of us are wondering, would we have ever seen that video, and could another story have been made up just for the mere fact that the way it all went down, and even right. after the video came out, it seemed that BART police, and I know you can't speak for BART police, right. but as a police officer yourself, we've never met before, but I can tell that you have a serious history in this. You're a scholar of the profession, and I think you're the best to ask that. But I guess my question isn't what do you think would have happened, but all of us were wondering, you know, if that kid hadn't taken that camera, would that case have turned out completely different, and would we have heard a different story?
Well, I got two parts. If you're saying that the officers, if the department would have had any video, I would like to think that it would have come out, because the failure to come out or to use it to investigate would really compromise the entire criminal justice system. And you would be asking a lot of people to be almost co-conspirators in a conspiracy.
Yeah.
And I don't think that would occur. The question that probably comes up most often is, what if there was no video? And all you had was the memory and the officer's testimony versus the community.
Yeah.
Looking at use of force investigations, I think it still would have been a tough one to do, because the officer's perception might have been that of danger or fear. But this is where you get into forensic science and trying to explain there was no weapon, the shot in the back. So I don't think so. I think it would be a more difficult task to look at to get to what really happened. I think that underscores the benefit of cameras. I like to believe that it, you know, people would have been candid in what they saw or didn't see and what happened. And I think the physical evidence would have still, the scientific evidence cannot be changed whether you have a camera or not. So I still think we would still be in the same place, quite frankly.
But do you know, you might very well have the physical evidence, you might mm-hmm. have the forensic evidence, and I think that gets us into something else. And there are those who would say that it's very, very difficult to convict a police officer once it goes to court.
Yes.
Once there's a trial, regardless of the forensic evidence.
It's or the video.
Way. Yes, exactly. And some would point to the Sean Bell case in mm-hmm. New York,
right.
where even one of the officers involved, when the verdict was read, was quite frankly surprised mm-hmm. that he was exonerated.
Right. And I think we've known that as a society that it is, I won't say juries are reluctant, but it is a tough. And I think a part of it is for juries and for people. One, most people want to believe that their officers in the police department are acting appropriately in their behalf. And two, there's always a hesitation to question the split second decision. And for a lot of people, they look at it as, well, you know, I wasn't out there. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. It was dark. There was an alley. He could have thought it was a gun. Why didn't a guy do this? And there's always, I think, so there's a natural tendency to want to believe those that you've entrusted with such power and responsibility. And there's a hesitancy to second guess decisions people have to make in the heat of the moment. But we still have to do it. And so I think the challenge for us is that the community should hesitate. I think the use of deadly force is the ultimate use by a police officer and has to come under intense scrutiny. And it can't be personal to the officer. It can't be personal that it somehow threatens the law enforcement, that we should expect and demand that whenever that firearm is used, that you should expect to be investigated by everybody that needs to investigate you and explain why it occurred so that people can have that confidence. So, I mean, are we there yet? It probably depends on the community.
Speaking of deadly force and the power of an officer to take a life, I have had a retired police officer or even a retired police chief on my show, the Talking with Henrietta show, talk about what it means sometimes for a police officer to shoot someone. And he said, and this is to, these aren't his exact words, but more or less the idea was, well, you haven't really arrived and earned your stripes until you've killed somebody. Is there any thinking like that that you might be aware of that gives an officer a certain level of respect that he would not have, that he's pulled out his gun and used it on someone?
No, and in fact, 98% of the police departments in this country will go their entire career without using their firearm. I've been chief for 4.5 years, and we take pride in that we haven't had to use deadly force. Most SWAT teams I know use logos like McDonald's, over a million served without a shot. They take pride that they can serve the search warrants without using deadly force. If you think about the criticism and the scrutiny that people go through to use deadly force, and understandably so, I don't know any officer that would want to put themselves in that category. It's not like there's not a parade. There's FBI, there's district attorneys, there's police departments, there's internal affairs, there's the community, there's the media, there's your kids going to school. Why'd your daddy or your mommy do that? That's not something that you would want to wake up in the morning saying, I think I'm going to do this because I'm going to be a hero.
When a police officer pulls out a gun, he is trained to shoot to kill. Is he? Is he not?
Not trained to shoot and kill. They're trained to shoot to stop the threat. And what that means is you are to use deadly force until your threat is no longer there. We would hope that, you know, obviously the better outcome is that no one dies, but you are trained to stop. So people ask, once you shoot it out the hands or the arms, the officers are also taught to shoot in most cases the largest part of the body so that they can actually hit. There is a fallacy that when a person gets shot, that they stop doing what they're doing. You know, like it is on TV, the gunshot goes, the guy flips over the chair, and that's the end of the conversation. And we know in reality it's not the case. So unfortunately, the officer may fire a round or two, and the person is still shooting at them. The person is still charging at them, so they shoot until a stop. If one shot stops the person, then they need to stop, and they should be accountable for every round they fire and justify that was needed in the defense of their life. So the shoot to kill would suggest that that's the intent, and I think the intent should be to stop the assault.
Well, when there might be bullets in the back and the person has turned to run, then that's something that's very questionable.
Well, I think any scenario in which you shoot somebody in the back, I would have a lot of questions. And so the question would be, what is the threat to the person? I mean, offhand, you can't say it because I could think of a scenario where it may not be scary. So, for example, if you had the DC snipers and this guy's running from you, what do you do? And so there's always, you see what I'm saying?
If you know it's the DC.
That's right.
But you see, that's it.
But you would
police
have to know.
Officers can right. be the judge and the jury and the right. executioner all in one. And, you know, there have been these stories where they've just decided it's better for the public that this person is no longer there.
No.
Save the community the trial.
No, there is actually, and I don't think you rarely, and I used the DC sniper because it would have to be to that extreme for me to even blink an eye to say that was a justified shooting. But under the law, there is a fleeing that a person who is a fleeing felon that presents a clear and present danger to the community, that an officer can use deadly force to stop them. And so an example would be if you have a guy running around in a schoolyard, he's already shot a couple of kids and is running towards the main building, what do you do?
So take him out.
You have to. But obviously that's the minority of situations. But the idea, whenever someone is shot in a bag, I think you have to ask very tough questions, because by its nature, how can a person be a threat to you whenever going away? And I think the community, if they see a scenario like that.
That's a case that happened in San Jose. And not only was a person shot in the back and killed when he was fleeing, but it wasn't even the right person. The person who did it, was exonerated. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, a case like that isn't one that gives the community faith and hope, not only in the police system, but in the jury system and the judicial system.
There's two phrases I want you to take home with you, and one is legality versus legitimacy. And that's the biggest challenge we have in law enforcement, is that even though an action may be legal, does it question the legitimacy of the organization? And even with legal things, we have things lawful but awful. That in one sense, it could be legal and lawful, but it still has an awful outcome to the community. And that's why you want professional officers that use the discretion appropriately. And not because there's a lot of, if you talk to most officers, and I challenge you this, they will tell you that they probably could have legally discharged their firearm 4 or 5 times in their career, but chose not to because something told them that there was a better option. And so I think looking at legality is one thing, but we have to look at the legitimacy and what impact all this has on our community.
Chief, one quick. When something like what happened yesterday with 4 officers getting brutally gunned down when they were just sitting in a donut shop, minding their own business, does that send a chill through all the other police departments? You know, when police hear about this, does it get them a little extra tense? Like, man, I got to go back out there tomorrow. That could happen to me. Do you notice that?
Well, I mean, I think absolutely. It depends. Also depends on the scenario. Where this one would be very challenging is the officers weren't responding to a robbery. They weren't chasing an armed, person in a robbery or a shooting.
They're working on their laptops
at a coffee place.
Yeah.
And so this now means that the officer can't even put his or her guard down while at a coffee break. And maybe they should never have done so historically anyway. And so what concerns me when these cases occur, that it does bring the sense of mortality to the officers.
Yeah.
And so in some cases, it's good to remind them the incident's not good, but you use it to remind them their safety issues. But you still have to guard to make sure that it doesn't turn them to be so disconnected from the community, because they're always waiting for the assassin around the corner. That whenever they're talking to somebody, they got to have their hands on a gun. You can't turn to paranoia. It can increase safety. But paranoia is bad, because then people perceive that as that you're not comfortable in your own community. So there are challenges, and it's a tragic reminder that I would ask the community to keep in mind, that police officers are men and women. They have a noble profession, but they're imperfect in a sense that we're all imperfect. But the stress that they have to work under, the conditions they have to work under, and the knowing that you can be shot and killed every day when you go to work, most people don't have to deal with that. So there should be some understanding of the challenges, and hopefully people will appreciate the service they provide. And that's not to minimize the accountability they have to us, but there is a balancing act. And so the Lakewood, Washington one is a tragedy that will ring through. Even in East Palo Alto, as we just finished a trial with Richard May, it's just another stark reminder of what the officers face or could face on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Chief Davis, I want to thank you for coming in. Henrietta Burroughs, thank you so much. And let's not let this be the last time. Let's let this be the first, and let's keep doing this, okay?
Well, if I have anything to do with it, Bird, we'll keep doing it.
Okay, this was wonderful to both of you. And thank you for your time. Oh. And stand by for Raising Sand.